Hey, readers, we're back with another episode of Book Club Appetizer. We're your hosts, Abby
and Emma. Happy summer, readers. Happy summer, Abby.
Thank you.
In your opinion, what makes the perfect summer read?
Oh, I'm glad you asked. I think a great summer read consists of a few things. That the subject matter is not so intense that you have to write notes in the margin just to follow along. Like, that feels like school.
Yeah.
But it's also not complete fluff. And for me, I like books that have some suspense to it. Like those books that keep you reading in your lounge chair, like long after the sun has gone down.
All of a sudden you realize you can't even see the page.
And it's freezing.
Okay. Yes, totally agree. And you guys all know how Book Club Appetizer works. Abby and I are here with our snackable episode that's perfect for kicking off your book club meetings or just enhancing your personal reading experience.
Yep, we're all about making life easy. We pick titles that are awesome books to read, and if you so choose to discuss them amongst your friends, they definitely foster debate. And then we even bring the author into the studio for an exclusive interview you won't hear anywhere else.
And since, other than books, the number one thing we think about is snacks.
Very true.
We pair the perfect appetizer and the perfect cocktail recipe with each book.
And the book we read this month centers on a bunch of weight-obsessed fashionistas in New York City. So we're keeping it light this month, in deference to them, with a summer strawberry spinach salad. And I am not a weight-obsessed fashionista, but I have to say this salad is beyond good.
Plus, it's so nice not to have to turn your oven on when it's hot out.
It's very true. And so in addition to the fresh berries, there's like delicious creamy avocado, which I love, crunchy cucumber, and it's all tossed in this dressing that's made with Dijon and, oddly enough, maple syrup.
Yum.
We got this recipe from No Excuses Detox by Megan Gilmore, which we actually think the characters in this month's read would be obsessed with.
Totally. Not only are the characters in this book focused on staying skinny, they're also strutting all around New York City in some seriously tall high heels, like way taller than I would wear.
We would break our ankles.
For sure. Some of the women are jealous of one another, so we thought the cocktail we're sipping had absolutely the perfect name. It's called Bitter Swagger, and it's both tart and sweet, just like a few of the women in this book. Thanks to Brad Thomas Parsons, the author of Amaro, for sharing this one with us. Look for those recipes on readitforward.com/podcast.
Before we introduce this month's read, recap the plot, and invite the author into the studio, we have to warn you, this podcast may contain plot spoilers.
Although, we were pretty good this month.
We were. We stopped ourselves before we revealed too much, so you're welcome. But this month we read I'll Eat When I'm Dead by Barbara Borland, which is a rollicking debut novel that feels like The Devil Wears Prada married with Murder, She Wrote.
Perfect.
The novel takes place at Rage Fashion Book, a chic fashion magazine in New York City. As the novel opens, fashion editor Hillary has been found dead in a windowless room inside the office. At first, her death is just chalked up to unfortunate side effects of the unrelenting pressure to be thin. It's just assumed that Hillary dies of a heart attack after essentially starving herself to death.
But then, enter smoking hot NYPD detective Mark Hutton. He discovers a note of warning written in Hillary's own handwriting, sent before she died, and reopens the case to see if maybe there was something a little more sinister behind her death. His first interview is with Kat, the tall and willowy editor who worked just under Hillary.
Kat and her equally funky and gorgeous assistant Bess locate a mysterious beauty product in one of Hillary's old purses. And Detective Hutton urges the two to dig further into this company's line of products. And then we also meet Lou, who is the temporary replacement for Hillary, who is struggling to make a name for herself amongst the magazine's elite editors.
We won't tell you anything more specific. You'll need to read it for yourself to have the very fun experience that we had finding out exactly who done it. But Barbara's novel is so sharp, and it plays in the cultural zeitgeist of New York in ways that are reminiscent of books like The Nanny Diaries.
Oh, yes.
Read it for the descriptions of the editor's outfits alone, honestly. Barbara has insight into the sometimes bizarre world of magazines, and her depictions both seem totally heightened and completely believable at the same time.
It's very true. And, you know, like I was saying earlier about the perfect summer read?
Mm-hmm.
The suspense around the murder investigation makes this book fast-paced. Like, you don't want to put it down until you find out what happens.
Mm-hmm.
But the author also makes some really, really smart commentary about, you know, the impossible standards of beauty that women are held to nowadays. And also how fashion is ethically or sometimes unethically produced. And I found myself thinking about those topics long after I closed the book.
Yeah, additionally, I really enjoyed the way she skewered social media in the novel.
Yes.
It made me really think about the way that we're all perceived through the images we post on social media these days, and how that doesn't necessarily stack up with our real lives.
Yes. It's a little deceiving. Okay, well, we could discuss this sharp and witty novel of fashion and beauty and murder all day, but we have some questions that only the author can answer. So stay tuned. We'll be right back with I'll Eat When I'm Dead author Barbara Borland in the studio after this brief message.
This episode of Book Club Appetizer is brought to you by Season of Stories from our friends at Penguin Random House. It's no secret that the inbox can be a pretty hectic, miserable place. The Season of Stories aims to change that by delivering great stories from award-winning authors directly to your inbox. And did we mention it's free? Sign up at theseasonofstories.com today before the season ends. That's theseasonofstories.com.
And now we welcome Barbara Borland, author of I'll Eat When I'm Dead, into the studio. So I'm here with Barbara Borland, author of I'll Eat When I'm Dead. Welcome, Barbara.
Hi, Abby. Thanks so much for having me.
So I'll Eat When I'm Dead has been described as The Devil Wears Prada meets American Psycho. What inspired you to take the women's magazine setting and introduce a murder mystery?
Oh, gosh. That's tough to say. I think the moment that I came up with the book was actually related to one of the characters, not necessarily the central mystery, but I love a mystery. I think that it's my ideal genre to read. It's my favorite genre to write, of course. And it puts you in an interesting position as a reader. A mystery requires you from the very first page to be asking questions about what you're looking at. And I think that this jives well. It's not so much the concern of women's magazines per se, but of women's media in general. I think we're all going through a big kind of cultural transition in terms of how we think about our bodies, our appearance, our self-worth. And that sort of falls under the banner of contemporary ethics. So I would say that like a mystery and ethical questions go hand in hand, because totally. You're putting a reader in a place where they're not taking anything at face value.
Totally.
So that's sort of that combination, but it wasn't necessarily a strategic choice. It just was what felt like the right way to tell that story.
So our protagonist, I love her, Kat Ono.
Mm-hmm.
Where did you get the inspiration for her? Is she sort of a model of anyone you know in real life?
Yeah. So it's weird. This book came to me in a moment 5 years ago, 5 years and 2 months. I know what day it was because I emailed a draft of this to myself. The night before, my husband had been, who had been on the academic job market, who had been getting a PhD in art history at the University of Chicago, had sat down with me late at night and been pretty nervous about the job market. And he asked, what else could I do if it's not this? And I didn't really know what else he could do, because he sort of spent 7 years studying kind of doing like a semiotic mapping of visual culture, which doesn't necessarily have that many remunerative applications, shall we say, And so I didn't know what he would do. And I went to work the next day and I was still thinking about it. And I was working at Harpo Studios in Chicago. And I worked at a desk with, like, you know, three computers and a TV screen, and kind of disappeared into the Borg every day. And so I would leave at lunch and I would go have a cigarette and I would walk around the block and get some fresh air and try to feel like a human being. And so I was doing that the next day and I was thinking about what Ian had asked. And I wondered kind of, you know, what he could do. And I sort of had this joke thought, oh, well, he could always work in a magazine. But of course, it would have to be a really progressive magazine. And I had this, yeah, I had this series of thoughts and I typed it into an email draft in my phone and saved it. And it was this weird little sketch that I was working out, I guess, as a way to deal with my anxiety about whether or not Ian was going to get an academic job, which he did get a job. So the main character in the book went ABD on a PhD from UChicago and works at this magazine called Rage Fashion Book, which is my total fantasy about fashion magazines. And that, one, it is the most glamorous office I could ever imagine anyone working in. Both in very good and very strange ways. And two, the preoccupation of the magazine is luxury goods that are absolutely made with living wage labor, which is in real life very hard to find.
Yeah, so, right, the clothes in Rage Fashion Book are all ethically made. Mm-hmm. And why was that a really important component for you to include? And do you think this could ever happen in real life?
I love clothing. I love getting dressed. It feels like self-expression. It feels like a way in which I tell other people about what kind of person I am or how I feel or how I want to be treated. And it's not always completely successful, but nonetheless, it feels like expression. But we live in a day and age in which I think it's pretty hard to be interested in clothing but not absorb any information about how your clothing is made. I think we're all pretty aware that retailers are generally engaged in a fairly brutal race to the bottom, whether it's the Rana Plaza collapse in Bangladesh or even the sweatshop scandals in the 90s that happened with Nike and with, you know, the Gap. We're all aware. And I don't, as much as it feels like to be a modern woman is to have the opportunity to express myself, to wake up, put on pants, drive a car, you know, have a job, don't have to get married, don't have to have children, to be able to do so many things. When it comes to clothing, that is, it can often be, if it's cheap clothing, it's at the expense of another woman who doesn't get to do all of those things at all. I found it probably over the last decade. I find it really hard to shop. It's not hard to shop secondhand. That is easy to do. Those goods have been made. But I find it hard to walk into a store, frankly. So, yeah, I was, in terms of figuring out where that character could go, who's this ersatz bizarro world version of my husband, yeah, it had to be at a place that had, you could really look up to, that had some real values. And I don't, I think in real life, to make a commercial success of that, set of values would be very challenging. Mm-hmm. Certainly there are websites that are doing it.
But what better way than fiction to work out that sort of dream of what if?
It's a total fantasy. That's exactly. Yeah.
So this novel is dripping in satire, which I love. You gleefully skewer a lot of the fashion world. So what was fun about writing that way?
Oh my, well, it is, like, everything that comes out of my mouth or onto my keyboard, it is half a joke and half completely sincere. I don't know how I live this way, but I do. I'm kidding and I'm not all the time. And I really do love clothing. And I have spent probably, you know, we're in this really interesting time. I sort of can't emphasize this enough. Like, our mothers were really the first generation. Sorry, I'm a millennial. My mother's a baby boomer. So our mothers were really the first ones to go to work and have careers in this sort of massive way. And so we haven't been going to work for that long. And we're still all figuring out, you know, men can put on a suit and they can shave their faces and they can have a firm handshake. They can do the Lyndon Johnson thing where they reach over and grab somebody on the shoulder and it's dominating. You know, they have all these ways to express themselves. And for women, it's really challenging to figure out how to be powerful in a way that isn't sexualized or seen as aggressive in an unwelcoming way. And maybe we're never going to be welcome. Maybe we can't resolve it with clothes. But
Have you seen any part of this fashion world firsthand?
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, I am so entertained anytime I open up a women's magazine. I really am. Sometimes it's like such an exciting fantasy. You know, you look at Vogue and you can kind of, if you, for those longtime readers of Vogue out there, you can tell who's kind of done what editorial. If it's, you know, a woman with like a crazy long wig and a princess dress in a forest who looks like she's going to be eaten by a dragon, it's Grace Coddington. And that speaks to a certain kind of fantasy we have about our identities. And then other times, you know, you have women kind of like wearing a wig over their face and doing the pose with the hands on the hips and curving the shoulders around. And I find all of these stories about women's identities and these presentations of women's identities to be extremely powerful. I think we're still really learning how to be, and we look to women's magazines and to women's media to teach us what we're supposed to look like and how we're supposed to express ourselves. Mm-hmm. That's kind of the modeling that we get, and that modeling can be sort of unabashedly negative if we think of the sort of heroin chic era of the 90s, or if we're talking about a more modern media experience. You look at Refinery 29, and they do such a great job, I think, on social media of using models from all different size, weight, racial backgrounds to do all kinds of different beauty tricks in a really fun, quick, exciting way. You know, so you'll see someone with like a really big curl, kind of like natural hair, doing a crazy awesome like braid pompadour, or you'll see someone from East Asia putting, you know, like gold lacquer on their eyelid. You see a lot of variety, and I think that is helpful.
When you were writing your female characters who do possess a lot of power, especially our editor-in-chief, Margot, were there any real-life women that you'd look to as sort of models for her character?
Absolutely. So Helen Gurley Brown took over Cosmopolitan magazine in the 60s. And she did it in a really interesting way after writing Sex and the Single Girl, which is a very, now very famous, but also pretty anachronistic text. She was connected through her husband to the publisher at Hearst, and she wound up kind of pitching him completely on her own about taking over Cosmo. He sort of groused to her that, oh, my women's magazines aren't doing well. And she kind of thought, well, that's an opportunity. And she walked into his office and she pitched him. And he said, okay, that's fine. You can have that. And I thought that was such an interesting way to start that. So, yes, Margot, the editor-in-chief, is sort of same background, same founding story. Her first husband, I think it is, first husband, second husband, I don't know. I don't remember how many husbands she has. One of them is friends with the publisher of Cooper House, which is the magazine publisher of Rage Fashion Book. And she pitches him on the idea when the magazine starts in the 80s, the early 80s, that they should focus on American-made goods. And there's a long history of that in women's magazines, of women who run women's magazines being these kind of economic drivers. In the 40s, saying, you know what, the American glove industry is dying, so let's put gloves in the magazine. Certain kinds of hats, certain kinds of fabrics, trying to have control over what has been a pretty local garment industry until like the last 30 years. So as that begins to decline, Margot thinks that there's an opportunity there. She thinks that, you know, American women, she says, women are the new men, and they fucking love to shop. And she thinks there's a moment here to focus on labor. And of course, Helen Gurley Brown and Cosmopolitan magazine have focused on the politics of sex and sexual liberation. And I wanted to make that a little more relevant to my own interests. So I made it about labor. So the magazine starts with a preoccupation focusing on American-made goods, and then it moves into living wage with the sweatshops in the 90s. And then it makes yet another pivot in the novel towards sustainability, which is sort of actually the hardest part of the garment industry. Because to make a polyester blouse, like a bright carmine red, you really have to use a fair number of heavy metals. And so the dyeing that happens is done in places that are incredibly unregulated, where populations have zero control over their governments. And so as a result, the garment industry is the number two polluter of the world's waterways, potable waterways, after agriculture.
Wow.
Which is a lot of dye, man.
Yeah. Well, and another commentary that this book makes is on the impossible quest for perfection and tiny waistlines, especially. So what are you hoping to say about our culture's impossible standards of beauty?
Gosh, well, part of it is that's all marketing, right? If you want to sell anything and you know that it's going to be aspirational, it has to be the thing that people can aspire to but never actually be, because once they become it, then they stop spending money, right? And I feel every time I walk into a store, every time I see an advertisement, anytime I'm really marketed to at all, I feel that I'm being told to become thinner, blonder, whiter. My skin, my teeth, my eyeballs, it's all got to be whiter. It's all got to be lighter. And you can spend, and there's so many ways in which this happens in marketing. It can be towards health. You know, we can have a whole dialogue about health. We can go on juice fast for health. And that's about thinness. Let's not kid ourselves. And this is all fine. I mean, you can, again, our lives are our own. If you would like to spend your life making your body a work of art into which you change its shape and you change its strength, that's completely, obviously, of course, do as you please. But I think for many of us, our self-worth is tied up in that process, and that's not great for us, maybe. Because we can be lots of other things other than our outsides. And for many, many generations, it mattered what women looked like on the outside because our economic futures had to do with marriage. Mm-hmm. But that's not true anymore. So why are we still doing it? Because we love it, because it feels like self-expression.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, really, fashion and beauty are not, it's not something that you do for yourself. There's a lot of forces that are at play, which is both good and bad. They're trillion-dollar global industries that impact tens of millions of workers.
Legislation,
et cetera. So that all, there's that. And you can take it seriously or you cannot take it seriously, but have some awareness of what you're looking at when you go into a store. Mm-hmm. and what you're doing to yourself. Because, like, how many times have you had this conversation with a friend? Pants. Like, oh, I don't want to go try on pants. Like, I don't need the, like, self-esteem destroyer of going to try on pants.
Right.
And why is that true? Yeah. Why is my self-esteem so fragile that it can be impacted by just trying on pants? What is that about? You know what I mean? Because I can get, my self-esteem is remarkably robust in other ways, and yet
it can be destroyed by pants.
Pants, swimsuit, there's these moments, it's easily bruised, I think, when it comes to our appearances, and I wish that wasn't the case for myself.
Yeah. Well, and for the characters in this book, appearance is everything. And so do you think that has increased in our society with the sort of carefully filtered images on Instagram and social media?
Oh, gosh. Yes and no, because we also all know that it's faux, right? Certainly the process of here's an interesting thing about magazines, right? So magazines used to be that we had the people on the masthead who were part of a particular social class, and they're giving us their taste, and they're the ones who get to have the experience of the shoot, right? The really exciting thing that you think of when you look at a magazine. You just think, oh, my gosh, how fun was that to paint that model's face with purple stripes and to make her wear this orange wig and to throw a bucket of milk at her. I mean, no, I guess it sounds kind of abusive. But you look at it and you think, gosh, that's creativity. You know, you look at it and it really does feel like fine art. To get to handle all the clothes and choose everything. So that it was a purely voyeuristic act, right, to buy a magazine because you could buy into the idea, the mental adventure of what had taken place there. And with, obviously, the rise of social media, we can all be our own magazines. Mm-hmm. We all get to have the experience of choosing what to look at and how to look at it. So we're more aware of it. I don't know that it's necessarily bad. Also, the horse has left the barn. So moralizing about whether or not it's good for bad for us isn't going to really do any good.
Right.
Let's just be more conscious of what makes us feel good and what makes us feel bad.
But I like the self photo shoot as the great equalizer. It's like, it's no longer inaccessible.
It's not. Yeah. It's not. If you want to spend all afternoon
taking selfies,
putting on crazy makeup and trying on outfits and taking selfies, which is a very fun activity.
Exactly.
It's a very fun way to spend your day.
Where does the title of this book come from?
Ah, the title. So the title of this book is a quotation that was printed in The New Yorker in 2011. And when I first drafted this book, is this weird emotional joke getting back at my husband, processing his stress, whatever. I did write this title in from that article. It's a quotation from Daphne Guinness, who is the heiress to the Guinness beer fortune, and who, if we're judging a book by its cover, is a fascinating person. She's Gen X, so she's a generation older than me. I won't speculate on her exact age, but she's not a Barbie. You know, she has an amazing white bouffant with a black skunk streak in it, and she wears hoof shoes and crazy capes from the 17th century, and she collects clothing, and she was friends with Alexander McQueen, and you look at her and you think, that's amazing. You are your own adventure. You know, just being next to you would be its own fascinating adventure. And she did an interview with The New Yorker with Rebecca Mead, who writes for them about fashion, among other things, and was quoted in the article during a photo shoot for, I think it's German Vogue, and she's leaning against a wall, and her assistant tries to get her to eat something, and she says, I can't eat when I'm working. You know, I'll eat when I'm dead. And I thought it was really telling that someone who has so much money and is otherwise what appears to me to be an incredibly creative, thoughtful person is still falls prey to the idea that thinness is something that is important.
Yeah.
And it's just not.
Yeah.
So,
what do you hope readers take away from this book?
I really hope that when readers walk away from this book, they feel that they have a little bit of mental footing, a little bit more clarity about how to detach their self-esteem from their appearance. I do. I genuinely hope that. If that is not available to them for whatever reason, I hope that they're entertained. I mean, it is an incredibly fun. I realize I've been kind of serious on this podcast. I think it's a fun book. It's not a moralizing delivery.
It's a super fun book, and it's like the tastiest sort of donut. Great for summer reading, but there are a lot of these serious underlying concepts, which is sort of what I wanted to get at. It's one of those books that you read and then continue to think about long after you've finished the last page. So thank you so much for being here, Barbara. This is great.
Oh, yeah. This was a delight. Thanks for asking all these questions.
Thanks for listening, readers. We have some reader questions on our site, in addition to a link to the awesome Spotify playlist that Abby put together to accompany Barbara's book. All songs you can picture strutting through New York City to.
And if you liked I'll Eat When I'm Dead and want to read more books like it, the Read It Forward team has suggested a few recommendations on readitforward.com/podcast. I mean, after all, we don't want to leave you without a great book to read. And we're producing monthly episodes centered on fantastic books we think you should pick up. So when you need something new to read, come see what we've been reading recently.
And whether you've listened to all of our podcast episodes or you're a first-time listener, we'd love to know what you think of our show. We're also thinking about mixing up our format a little bit. So if there's anything you love or anything you don't love quite so much, we'd really appreciate hearing from you. Take a minute and leave us a review on iTunes.
And as always, don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Read It Forward and tweet about books with us. Happy reading and cheers!